Chapter 13, Arms Reach. Families file out of the city, their belongings bundled into bags on their backs or stacked high on ox-drawn carts. Small children toddle alongside their parents, some hanging onto their mother's skirts, others clutching their father's legs. Those too young or too tired to walk are carried on adults' shoulders. The women and children of one household are squeezed into a cart, balanced on their baggage. One woman cradles an infant on her lap, while the arms of an older child, sitting behind her, are clasped around her waist. The motley procession makes its way across the hilly landscape, past trees and vines heavy with fruit. But this is no liberating exodus. Soldiers force the long line of men, women and children from their city, taking them past impaled corpses, flayed bodies and a local dignitary forced onto his knees to have his throat slit. The traumatised families are being marched towards their fate, incorporation into Assyria. The supreme power of the empire is embodied by King Sennacherib himself, who sits upon a lofty throne, upheld by divine beings, overseeing the sack of the city and the parade of the spoils of war. The fall of the Judahite city of Lachish at the end of the 8th century BCE barely gets a mention in the Bible, yet it was a city significant enough that its sack was monumentalised in a vast frieze in Sennacherib's southwest palace in Nineveh, celebrating the subjugation of his far-flung territories. The Assyrian attack on Judah, an imperial vassal, had been triggered by the rebellion of its king, Hezekiah. Encouraged by promises made by a resurgent Egypt and a deal struck with the flashy Babylonian king Marduk-apla-iddina II, known in the Bible as Merodach-Baladan, Hezekiah withheld the imperial tribute. It was a reckless decision. Just 20 years before, Judah's northern neighbour, the Kingdom of Israel, had been annihilated for rebelling against its Assyrian emperor. Its gods were captured, their temples emptied, and King Hoshea imprisoned. The kingdom was snuffed out and replaced with an Assyrian province called Samarina, taking its name from the fallen capital, Samaria. Now, Judah itself was on the brink of oblivion. "Do not be afraid or dismayed before the king of Assyria," Hezekiah reportedly said to his people. "With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles." It was an overconfident declaration. Judah was decimated. Jerusalem was left standing alone, like a booth in a cucumber field, with Hezekiah trapped in the besieged city, like a bird in a cage, as Sennacherib mockingly declared in his war reports. Cut down to size and cowed into remorseful obedience, Hezekiah paid the heavy tribute the empire demanded, which included his own daughters. Jerusalem was spared. Slowly, its inhabitants recovered their confidence, crediting the city's escape from annihilation to the protective presence of Yahweh in his temple. "God is in the midst of the city, it shall not be moved," cult singers proclaimed. "Great is Yahweh, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. Within its citadels, God has shown himself a sure defence." By the middle of the 7th century BCE, Assyria was beset by a series of civil wars, weakening the empire's hold on its territories, much to the delight of its rivals, Egypt and Babylonia. Judah was now caught between these warring powers, bending and buckling in the changing tides of empire. One after another, Judahite kings were killed, captured, or exiled at the command of competing foreign powers. In 612 BCE, King Nabopolassar of Babylon captured Nineveh, the imperial seat of Assyria, and with it the empire's heartlands. Having gained control of Mesopotamia, the newly expanded Babylonian empire set its sights on driving Egypt back from its incursions into the Levant by taking these territories for itself. In 597 BCE, the Babylonians invaded Judah and seized Jerusalem. Judah's king, Jehoiakim, was exiled to Babylon, along with key members of his court and some of the city's religious leaders. Others, wealthy enough or lucky enough to flee, made their way to Egypt. Babylon placed a more malleable member of Judah's royal family, Zedekiah, on the throne. But Egypt kept up the pressure on its southern Levantine targets, and Zedekiah proved a pushover. In 587 BCE, he rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, who immediately attacked. Jerusalem was sacked and the kingdom destroyed. Fettered like an animal, Zedekiah was carted off to Babylon, along with most of the city's remaining political and religious elites. Monstrous chaos had overwhelmed the kingdom of Judah. "He has devoured me, he's crushed me," Jerusalem cried of Nebuchadnezzar. "He's swallowed me like the dragon, he's filled his belly with my delicacies, he has spewed me out." Yahweh blamed the machinations of Egypt's king, whose disorder had been as repugnant as it was disruptive. "You're like the dragon in the seas, thrashing about in your streams, stirring up the water with your feet, fouling your streams," he is said to have declared. But some worshippers blamed Yahweh himself, casting him as their inexplicably angry attacker. "We've not forgotten you or been false to your covenant. Our heart hasn't turned back, nor have our steps departed from your way. Yet you have crushed us in place of the dragon." Whoever was to blame, Judah's kings had proved themselves unable or unworthy in their divinely ordained task to subdue earthly chaos. But Yahweh's role as the monster slayer lived on. Exiled elites drew on their ancient myths to petition their divine warrior to free them from captivity and restore them to their homeland. "Bow your heavens, O Yahweh, and come down," they prayed. "Make the lightning flash and scatter them. Send out your arrows and rout them. Stretch out your hand from on high. Set me free and rescue me from the mighty waters." For these worshippers, God's cosmic conflicts not only painted the turbulent world in vivid technicolor, but illustrated the profound personal distress of those drowning in the chaos of cultural trauma. From the depths of misery emerged some of the most heart-wrenching pleas in the Bible. "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I've come into deep waters and the flood sweeps over me," sobs one poet. "I'm weary with my crying, my throat is parched, my eyes grow dim with waiting for my God." The interrelation of the mythic and the personal was more than notional. One of the most artfully crafted poems in the Bible reflects the prayers of an exiled community of Judahites in 6th century BCE Babylon, who imagined their return as a second exodus, crossing the dangerous Sea of Reeds into the promised homeland. Moving from the mythic to the political to the personal, the poem shifts from the brutality of Yahweh's battle with the sea dragon to escape from oppression in a foreign land to the emotional salve of a pilgrim's journey to the Jerusalem temple. And it's specifically the arm of Yahweh that's addressed, transforming the deity's limb of brute force into a guiding hand of comfort. "Awake, awake! Put on strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake, as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the sea, Yam, the waters of great deeps, mighty Tahom, who made the depths of the sea, Yam, a way for the redeemed to cross over? So the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with singing." The idea that God's powerful arm was merely sleeping rather than weakened or broken was typical of ancient religious devotion. Despite the destruction of his temple in Jerusalem, Yahweh was not a god who had been defeated by Babylon, but a deity who had deliberately abandoned his people, withdrawing his powerful protective arm. "Why do you hold back your hand?" went the plaintive cry. "Why do you keep your hand in your bosom?" If the divine arm was sleeping, it was because Yahweh was too. Across the ancient world, restful sleep was as normal an activity for gods as it was for humans, and some temples were equipped with ornate beds to which their divine residents would retire at night. Like their worshippers, however, deities might also take to their beds as a means of retreating from the social world, whether because they were sulking, depressed, or punishing their people. According to a Sumerian lament, this is precisely what the great god Enlil did. Having afflicted his land with a famine, the old god shut himself up in his temple at Nippur, whereupon he pretended to be asleep while his punished people starved. Swift measures, and a certain degree of flattery and mollycoddling, were required. The goddess Inanna travelled from her temple in Uruk to Nippur in the hope of rousing Enlil. "Feigning, my father feigns lying down," she cried. "May I soothe his heart, may I pacify his liver, may I direct my words to his distressed heart." Sitting on his lap, she sings him awake with the refrain, "Oh, sleeping one, how long will you sleep?" Inanna's lament was considered so powerful that her cult singers recited it in her temple at Uruk on the seventh day of each month in the hope of appeasing the gods for any unknown misdemeanor which might prompt untimely or simulated slumber. Precautionary measures were only sensible. Discerning the difference between a sleeping god and a sulking god was not always easy. Many centuries later, in the 6th century BCE, Yahweh's worshippers were singing petitions to awaken him to the devastating aftermath of the Babylonian attack. "Rouse yourself! Why do you sleep, O Yahweh? Awake! Do not cast us off forever!" For those left in Jerusalem, Yahweh's prolonged sleep likely marked the relatively short period in which his broken temple was completely out of action. But for Jerusalem's former elites, now living in exile, Yahweh's sleep endured for several generations. Most eventually got on with their new lives, reconfiguring their god into a deity easily accessible in the diaspora. On Elephantine, an island in the Nile, a mixed community of Yahweh worshippers, some exiles and refugees, some economic migrants, built a temple to their god and two companion deities, about whom we know very little, the god Eshem Bethel and the goddess Anat Yahu, perhaps a consort of Yahweh himself. There, they offered sacrifices again. But some exiles in and around Babylon, Marduk's own city, believed that Yahweh of Jerusalem remained firmly territorial, and only their return to Zion could reunite them with their god. And yet, this was a theological position fraught with anxiety. What if Yahweh's mighty arm was simply too weak or too short to reach into an enemy territory to rescue his scattered citizens? It was a claim Yahweh vociferously denied, drawing on his subjugation of watery chaos to prove his point. "Is my hand shortened that it cannot redeem? Or have I no power to deliver? By my rebuke I dry up the sea, I make the rivers a desert." It was also a claim seemingly put to rest when King Cyrus II of Persia toppled Babylon in 539 BCE and decreed the return of displaced peoples to their homelands, where they were to rebuild their temples and restore their gods, a canny political move designed to pitch the new emperor as a benevolent patron of the oppressed. Suddenly, Yahweh awoke like a warrior shaking off wine and opened his armory and brought out the weapons of his wrath. Furious at any implication that he had been disarmed or sedated by Babylon, or even rescued by Persian Cyrus, Yahweh adorned himself with the regalia of a champion fighter, itemized in the book of Isaiah as a breastplate, helmet, and ceremonial robes. He then raised his mighty arm, ready to avenge his people, rescue his exiles, and salvage his godly reputation. His own arm saved him, and his righteousness upheld him. The idea that a god might need to rescue his own reputation was not uncommon, but it did give rise to one of the most extraordinary verses in the Bible. According to a poem in Deuteronomy, Yahweh had always planned to use foreign nations to wipe out his people altogether, young man and woman alike, nursing child and old greyhead. But he reversed this decision upon realizing that foreign nations might claim the genocidal massacre as the work of their own hands rather than his, and he confesses he was afraid of the potential humiliation. I might have reduced them to naught and blotted out the memory of them from mankind, but I feared the taunts of the foe, their enemies who might misunderstand and say, our own hand is triumphant, it was not Yahweh who did all this. In the aftermath of the exile, Yahweh simply had to wake up and arm himself like a warrior again. Glimpses of his return to form are offered in prophetic oracles embedded in biblical texts of the Persian period. He flexes his muscular arm like a bodybuilder as he accompanies his repatriated exiles in triumphal procession back to Jerusalem. Lookouts in the city spy him covered in blood, his holy arm held aloft, as he returns from a quick detour to punish the Edomites who had helped the Babylonians to destroy his temple. Back in his city, worshippers sang praises to his right hand and holy arm, raised in victory like a champion boxer in the rebuilt sanctuary, while the chastened waters of chaos and its monstrous inhabitants were encouraged to cheer and applaud their oppressor. His right hand and his holy arm have saved him. Yahweh has made known his victory. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the rivers clap their hands. The Hebrew Bible gives the impression of a vast return of exiles to Judah following in the train of God. But the reality was rather different. While most remained in Babylonia and Egypt, only a few hundred would trickle back to the homeland in the late 6th and early 5th centuries BCE. The former kingdom of Judah was now the tiny Persian satrapy of Yehud, governed by civil servants, within a much larger imperial province given the no-frills moniker Beyond the River. Jerusalem itself had a population of little more than 2,500, while its newly rebuilt sanctuary would remain only a relatively modest structure until well into the Hellenistic period. Even so, the initial rebuilding of Jerusalem's temple in the late 6th and early 5th centuries BCE and the imagined return of its divine warrior marked a new chapter in the story of Yahweh and the sea monster. For the returnees, God had proved himself perfectly capable of recruiting the powerful Cyrus as his messianic or anointed servant, moving into foreign lands to bring his worshippers home and facilitating the Persian sponsorship of his new temple. With a guiding hand in international politics, Yahweh's reach was increasingly perceived by many of his devotees to be ever greater. His power was unmatched by foreign gods, his control over chaos supreme. Worshippers looked forward to his imminent punishment of those who had revelled in the suffering of his people. Prophets declared it would be a day of unbridled ferocity, climaxing in the slaying of the dragon once and for all. On that day, Yahweh, with his cruel and great and strong sword, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent. He will kill the dragon that is in the sea. As Jerusalem's priests and literati grew increasingly comfortable amid the relative calm and economic stability of Persian imperial rule, Yahweh's primeval, fearsome foe became ever easier to subdue. In the myths upholding his mighty arm, overpowering his old enemy was now less of a violent battle and rather more like trapping a flapping fish. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook or press down its tongue with a cord? God now boasted in a lengthy monologue in the book of Job. Losing none of its formidable form, the chaos monster moved from disempowered enemy who spoke soft words of supplication to its captor to a tamed animal whom Yahweh could play with as a bird and put on a leash as a toy for young girls. Just as Babylon's Marduk had once domesticated a monster, rendering it a faithful companion, so too Yahweh found himself the owner of a pet dragon. The monster was now cast as a creature of God, divinely formed on the fifth day of creation to fill the great sea, a monster Yahweh had tended on the day of its watery birth, wrapping the boisterous baby in swaddling bands to calm its writhes and wriggles. The monster's revised role in creation gave it a renewed purpose. Yahweh had made the monster precisely to enjoy spending time with it, as his worshippers declared with delight. There is the sea, great and wide, and Leviathan, whom you formed to play with. This was less a reinvention of the Southwest Asian combat myth than a re-emphasis of some of its oldest themes, in which cosmic monsters were born of the gods themselves, who felt great affection for their skittish, troublesome offspring. The notion that Yahweh enjoyed playing with his sea monster would endure well into the Common Era, and proved so appealing that rabbis would subsequently confirm he had timetabled this activity into his daily program. After a busy morning working on the Torah and sitting in worldly judgment, followed by an industrious afternoon meeting out mercy and feeding the earth's inhabitants, God would relax in the evening by playing with Leviathan. It was a divine pastime which spoke as much to the gentle-handedness of the biblical God as to his effortless control of the forces of disorder in the cosmos. Either way, the warrior god was increasingly disinclined to fight, for he was effortlessly able to keep chaos in check. If disaster befell his worshippers again, it would be a just punishment, orchestrated from a heavenly distance and with a heavy heart by God himself. So heavy a heart, some rabbis later assumed, that God would bind his own right arm behind his back to prevent his instinctive intervention. Disarmed and constrained, he would suffer in solidarity with his punished people. The cultural memory of a violent cosmic battle did not disappear, however. Instead, it shapeshifted like ancient Tiamat herself, taking on new forms as the political world changed around Yahweh's worshippers. As the relative stability of the Persian era gave way to more unsettled, divisive, and often oppressive conditions during the Hellenistic and Roman periods, some Jewish seers saw the waters of chaos rising again, embodied this time by the monstrous forms of their unrighteous opponents or foreign overlords. Their anxieties would be articulated in some of the Bible's most esoteric literature, including the 2nd century BCE Book of Daniel, which drew on the rise and fall of empires to announce the impending ascent of a glorious new world order. Here, the pseudonymous seer presents a carefully controlled version of the chaos myth to describe the downfall of successive oppressive nations, portrayed as terrifying beasts crawling out of a whipped-up primordial sea. They are to be usurped by a heavenly figure of human-like shape, described as one like a son of man, who would appear riding on a cloud chariot and be appointed to kingship over a new world order by an aged deity enthroned in the divine council called the Ancient of Days. This mystical narrative is best known for its subsequent use as a proof text endorsing the New Testament portrayal of Christ as the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. But in Daniel, this vision was just one expression of a persistent mythic constellation which would find its way into other Jewish writings of the Hellenistic and Roman periods. Some similarly described a divine Son of Man riding on the clouds of heaven, this time over the primeval sea, causing it to shrivel or tremble. Others envisaged an angelic mediator exercising God-given dominion over Leviathan, who was painfully pinned beneath the divine throne. These writers' worldviews were fundamentally shaped by the traditional Southwest Asian dragon myth, the kernel of which told of a young warrior god winning kingship, having vanquished or tamed monstrous, aqueous chaos. This mythic paradigm also framed the religious perspectives of some early Jewish groups of a more sectarian or mystical nature, who responded to the political and cultural changes wrought by the upheavals between the 2nd century BCE and the 1st century CE with end-time or eschatological visions. They looked forward to the end of the traumatic world, when the created realm would be destroyed entirely and a new cosmic order would arise. And if the old world had been made from the slaying of the chaos monster, its end was to come the same way. For many, the new death of chaos would be marked by the divine violence of old, with God or one of his divine agents, usually the Archangel Michael or Gabriel, hunting out the dragon and smashing its heads. For these anxious communities, watery chaos was no longer a dangerous force inclined to wayward disruption, but a cosmic evil actively set upon repeated rebellion against God and intent on inciting mortals to do the same through the provocations of its supernatural envoys, Belial, wickedness, and Mastema, hostility. God would wipe out this toxic presence by stretching the heavens high and low, like a cosmic concertina, and crashing them into the corrupted earthly realm, which would be sent hurtling into the abyss. Only the righteous would survive this apocalyptic terror to witness the staggering wonder of the new cosmic order. Early Jewish eschatology would shape the frightening visions of the great apocalypse in the early Christian book of Revelation. Dated to the end of the 1st century CE or the beginning of the 2nd, the book is self-ascribed to a seer named John, a figure traditionally but erroneously identified with the Apostle John. Whoever he was, he wrote with a fervent desperation to Christian communities in Roman Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, urging them to hold fast to their faith, for the end of the world was imminent. John reports that his visions transported him to the heavenly throne room of God, where he witnessed Christ's army of archangels battling a seven-headed, flood-spewing, frog-phlegmed chaos dragon, now named as that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. After several nasty skirmishes, the dragon was finally overpowered, bound with chains, and sealed into a bottomless pit. This triggered a new creation. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, John writes, for the first heaven and the first earth have passed away, and the sea is no more. Transcendentally distanced from the battle as an unseen presence, God himself had kept his hands clean of the conflict. Instead, a series of angels had grappled with the dragon until Christ appeared, equipped with a sword, a war horse, and a bloody tunic, ready to take the glory of the young warrior god. His reward would be divine kingship over God's universal empire. Not everyone imagined God would remain at arm's length. For many other early Jewish and Christian communities, the apocalyptic defeat of the cosmic sea dragon would not come with the messy shattering of the monster's many heads, its wrestling into chains, nor even its imprisonment in darkness. Instead, it would be marked by a more civilized end-of-times banquet. Summoning his most righteous worshippers to dinner in heaven, God would cater the final feast. Quickly and cleanly, he would dish up his pet dragon in salted slivers for his most righteous worshippers to consume. It was an image drawn on what was by now an ancient claim in the Psalms that Yahweh had crushed Leviathan's heads and fed him to wild beasts. Now, this was recast as a salvific Last Supper to be hosted by God at a time of his choosing. Having imprisoned Leviathan at the beginning of creation, God would fetch him up from his watery store and serve him up as fishy fillets, a dish that would be both physically nourishing and reassuringly kosher, as some rabbis would later confirm. God's mastery of chaos had become so thoroughly domestic that the monster was no longer a humbled servant, ferocious guardian, or beloved companion. Now, Leviathan was an animal raised to be cooked and eaten in a ritual meal, like a prized beast sacrificed from the sacred stall. This culinary twist on an old mythic trope offered God the renewed opportunity to showcase his more delicate, dexterous skills, a divine touch that had long shaped the lives of his worshippers.